Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Charity Charge Show. Today with us is Nora Super, who is the Executive Director at the Milken Institute Center for the Future of Aging. Nora, thank you so much for being on today.
Hi, Stephen. Glad to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Absolutely. I normally don't rush to hit record so quickly, but what I didn't want to get lost is sort of just the raw and kind of just direct nature of our conversation. We hopped on and just kind of were explaining pleasantries. And I mentioned to you it was my birthday yesterday, and you mentioned that yours is coming up in a week or so, which is awesome. Which day is it in April?
April 13th, next Wednesday.
Awesome. Well, happy early birthday to you. We're both Aries, which is very exciting.
Happy belated birthday to you.
Thank you. So I want to get into, you know, your background specifically and talk about, you know, directly what the Milken Institute and the center you run are doing. But I know you were just sharing a little bit about just kind of aging gracefully. So there were two key things that you found. What are those?
Yeah. Well, what I mentioned when we spoke is that I really think the two most important things you can do to age well is to be physically active and to have an optimistic attitude. And, you know, I've been studying aging most of my career, and there's just almost every disease that's associated with aging, whether it be diabetes or heart disease or dementia, you can dramatically reduce your risk by being active and physical. So the best thing you can do is move. And even if it's just, you know, walking everywhere as opposed to driving everywhere, which is what I try to do. But, you know, little things like parking a little far away from the grocery center. See, and I have a little step counter for when, you know, that I use to try to go 10,000 steps a day. And it also helps with your mood and your positivity, because when I forget something and have to run back upstairs to get it, then instead of saying, oh, I'm running late, I forgot this, I say, oh, well, I get more steps, you know, so I'm trying to turn it that way. And then there's also some research, especially by a woman named Becca Levy, who's at Yale, studied perceptions of aging and how that relates to how you feel about aging. So there's a lot of evidence that people who feel good about getting older actually enjoy their older years better than people that are afraid of it or see negative connotations. So, you know, we really work on trying to get rid of ageist stereotypes about people. So it's great now that some, you know, big movie stars are getting older too, because then people see positive examples of how you can still do a lot in your 60s and 70s. In fact, I watched West Side Story last night, you know, and I think Rita Moreno, I think she's like in her 90s.
Wow.
And if not her 80s, and she was amazing. She's like in this film production. She's, you know, did a solo song, she danced, she did all this stuff. So those kind of examples of aging, I think, give me optimism for what the future holds.
That's awesome. I really appreciate you sharing that. You had also mentioned, which I think is interesting, is why there's a lot of education and just sort of just general awareness now against the stigma of aging.
Yeah, so we, you know, we had seen this sort of moving positively before the pandemic, where especially as the baby boomers get into their 60s, we have in the U.S. 10,000 Americans turning 65 every day. And that trajectory has been going on since the first baby boomers started to retire and will continue. I'm actually was born in 1964, so I'm at the very trail end of the baby boom generation. And so it'll probably drop off after that. But as more people have entered older age, how they think about themselves has changed. And especially the baby boom generation were, you know, who, you know, not so much me, some of the older baby boom generation, but they were the hippies, you know, the anti-war people, the protesters, civil rights movement, et cetera. And so now that they're getting older, they're redefining what it means to be older and what's okay to do. So you see older people much more experimenting, like, you know, with their hair. You know, see older people with blue hair, multiple earrings and tattoos and, you know, whatever they want. There aren't really any rules anymore about what you're supposed to look like when you're over 60. And I think that's really liberating for people.
I love it. I think it's awesome. My mother recently turned 71 and, you know, I'm 36 now. And I'm also curious, like the perspectives on aging and how norms change. You know, 36 obviously seemed super old to me when I was a kid or even a teenager or in my early 20s. And now this is the first year that I feel like, whoa, like time has flown by. It actually kind of hit me, not in a negative or depressing way. But at the same time, I look at my parents, my mother and my stepfather, and they still seem so young to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like they're 70. What?
Right.
Research around that or just kind of any?
Oh, yeah, sure. No, that's definitely happening to all of us. You know, my sister was just here and she and her husband are in their 70s. And she was saying she felt really old. It wasn't when she turned 50 or 60, but when her oldest daughter turned 40, because she thought, if I have a child who's 40, you know, that's really middle age. So what does that make me? And, you know, I think that, I'm just about to turn 58. And so it's the same thing. One benefit I have is my husband's 10 years older than I am. So everybody thinks I'm young when I hang out with him and his friends, they're like, you're a baby. And, you know, I've been that way since I was in my 30s. So
right. It
always makes me feel young compared to them. But I do think the norms are changing. You know, you see people who, I ran a 10K a couple of years ago before the pandemic. And, you know, there was a woman who didn't start running until she was in her 60s. She was in her 80s and she was faster than I was. And, that really motivated me to get faster because it was like, wow, she could run this fast in her 80s and she didn't start till her 60s. So it's never too late to start new things and to try new things. And so I think that, you know, that's changing. I mean, I think the pandemic unfortunately set us back some because there was a lot of discussion of, you know, people that were over 60 were at higher risk for COVID. And, you know, that's definitely true, but it also made people feel like there were discussions about, well, just make all the old people stay home, or, you know, like, why are we disrupting everyone's lives for all these old people, as if people over 65 didn't matter. And so I think, you know, we lost a lot of ground there. And then, you know, a lot of people did have health complications associated with it. But I'm hopeful that as we emerge out of this, hopefully that we'll continue to make strides in that, because, you know, there are just so many opportunities for older people. I talk about where we have this workforce shortage now, and employers are really talking about difficulty in identifying talented people, is to really think about being more flexible. You know, a lot of older workers were forced to retire during the pandemic. They retired a lot earlier than they thought they would, and they still want to be engaged in the workforce. They might not want to work full-time anymore. And, you know, they might want to take one day off to, you know, go fishing or golfing or whatever is fun for them, but, or spending time with their grandkids, but then just, you know, have flexible hours, and they're willing to take a pay cut, but bring, you know, tremendous wisdom and expertise to the workplace. So I'm hopeful that there'll be more opportunities for older people to do the things that they want to do as they get older. Because some of the, you know, that's been some of the upsides of some of the ways our workplaces have changed during the pandemic.
I want to go down that thread, and then I'll pull it back, because I feel like I could talk to you for hours. What's the sense? Well, okay, I'm going to hold the question. Let me give a more proper kind of introduction, because we jumped into this, which has been fun. But Nora, I know in, you know, chatting with you prior a couple of weeks back, and then, you know, just kind of looking through your background, want to let the audience know, you know, for many years you were with AARP. And then you were director of public affairs HHS, Health and Human Services. Is that right?
Yeah.
And then you also were the executive director of White House Conference on Aging. Mm-hmm. And then from there, you were with the National Association of Area Agencies on Aging, and then took up your work at the Milken Institute. So can you give sort of a brief overview of kind of your lead up to joining Milken Institute, and then explain what is this Center for the Future of Aging all about? Why was it created? Why is what you were doing and your team's doing, why do you think it's important?
Sure. So I've spent all of my career in the nonprofit world or the government sector. And so, you know, I feel like I have a lot of experience in working in nonprofits, both big and small. I did work, AARP, of course, is a very large organization. I also worked at Kaiser Permanente, which is also a nonprofit and very large. And then I've worked for small organizations such as the National Association of Area Agencies on Aging that are now, is now called US Aging. They switched their name after I left. And I think the, you know, throughout my career, I kind of started out early on Capitol Hill, and then worked at a think tank called the Employee Benefit Research Institute, which really got me focused on health and retirement security issues very early on in my age, and helped form, you know, many decisions that I made about investing in my retirement security and in my health, because I learned a lot of these things when I was still pretty young. Then, you know, I started to specialize more. So I started to work more on Medicare health issues. And I was at George Washington University for a while, did several research papers on these issues, and decided to go to AARP because I was a little frustrated with academics that, you know, you wrote a lot of papers that seemed like they were just on a shelf and you weren't sure they were really going anywhere. So I've always been very interested in public policy, which was why I moved to Washington, D.C. I was a poli-sci major. I got a master's in public administration. And so I always wanted to be really active in getting things done. So when I was at AARP, I was actually a lobbyist for them and led their efforts during the enactment of the Affordable Care Act. So really trying to push for specific provisions for older adults that I'm still passionate about, but of course also very passionate about getting low cost health insurance for all Americans. But heard many stories during that period about certain things, like, you know, we're one of the only large countries, high income countries in the world that doesn't have universal access to health coverage. So as a result, a lot of things happen that impact people's lives and their ability to live long and healthy lives by not having insurance or not having financial security. I heard many stories from, it was primarily women, but they had always been on their husband's employer-based plan. And then when their husband might be a little older and became eligible for Medicare, the women were uninsured. And oftentimes they were, you know, in their early 60s, they had a lot of health conditions and they couldn't find affordable health insurance. So they were really scared. So that had an impact on me on trying to provide more protection to people so that, you know, a health event doesn't, you know, make them go bankrupt, which still happens in this country far too often. Sure. And, you know, so in that position, I got to know a lot of people on Capitol Hill, as well as in the Obama administration.
Can you pause there? Because I just have a general question that I'm unfamiliar with. I'm aware of the Affordable Care Act and, you know, healthcare.gov and whatnot. For my parents, right, that are in their 70s now, my understanding is they get Medicaid. Is that right? Or is it?
They get Medicare.
Medicare. So what's that all about? And what age does that kick in? And is basically everyone of a certain age becomes eligible for that?
Yeah. So in the American system, you're eligible when you turn 65, as long as you've paid into Social Security for a certain number of years. So naturalized citizens, immigrants aren't always eligible. But most Americans are eligible when they turn 65. There's some Americans that are eligible because of their disability, although the rules are pretty high to get that. So even once you are designated as a person with a disability, say, you know, someone with MS or ALS mm-hmm. or some other disease that prevents them from working anymore, it takes 2 years before you're eligible for coverage for Medicare. And again, our systems in the U.S. are just, you know, the way I look at them, and I talk more directly, is that they're kind of mean. You know, it's very much a world that thinks every man for himself, and mm-hmm. you know, you have to pay for everything out of pocket. And if you didn't have the good fortune to be wealthy or to do well in school or to, you know, have opportunities for you, then you have to struggle. And so there's a lot of inequality in our systems. So Medicare, though, is the great equalizer. And, you know, I've often said, and this has come up in some policy debates that we're having here, when you look at like who uses Medicare and how much they use it, you'll find that Black Americans and Latino Americans are much use the system. They're what we call high utilizers when they first become eligible, often because they didn't have steady health insurance most of their lives. And so when they finally become eligible, they want everything that they are entitled to, which is understandable, but that it's also, you know, there's some ways that our system is set up that make it not the best system, and it's fragmented and sort of encourages a lot of procedures and not really, you know, working with people as a whole person and what's best for their health. So that's one struggle there, but in general, Medicare pays for, you know, a percentage of your hospital and your physician office visits. There are co-pays and deductibles that can be quite high too. So there are state programs that cover it. If you become eligible for Medicaid based on your income, they'll cover some of that. There are also Medicare supplemental benefits. Medicare Advantage generally covers all of that. So there's a lot of layers of complexity into what you are eligible for. But for the most part, everyone over 65 is eligible for that. Now, you know, on Social Security, they've been slowly raising the age at which you become eligible. So I think now we're up to 66 and a half or something. I'll be eligible when I'm 67. And this was done back in the 1980s when we saw some of these population trends, and sort of asked me why aging is so important, is we've seen this, you know, phenomenon happening in the US, which is happening really all over the world, in some places of the world much more dramatically than others. But in the US now, we have, you know, more older adults than, you know, by 2030, we'll have more people over the age of 60 than under the age of 18 for the first time. So, you know, this is due to a lot of things. We have lower fertility rates, so people aren't replacing themselves anymore. So, with, you know, like two people having two children is, you know, just a stable replacement ratio. Well, people used to have much bigger families. When we look at caregiving as a responsibility, mm-hmm. it used to be around, you know, the number of family caregivers per older adult was like 7 to 1, and now we're down to 4 to 1. And you know, that includes the person's spouse, who can also be old and frail. You know, that includes their children that may live somewhere not nearby. You know, we just don't have the same culture where people used to stay in the same town for all of their lives, so you had multiple family members that could help out. And so it's really put a strain on folks as our older population increases and we don't have younger people to provide the care, but also to pay taxes and pay into these programs that we have. So, you know, because that's how we've sustained them over time, is that people who are working are paying taxes to help support the programs for older adults. So it's turning into sort of a fiscal, you know, priority now that we have to look at how we're gonna pay for these programs.
Got it. I really appreciate you sharing that. Yeah, I mean, it makes me wonder. And one of my follow-up questions is about aging and automation and trying to mm-hmm. think about things of that sort, which I'm going to ask in a sec. But I want to give you back the floor. I know before I asked you that most recent question on Medicare, Medicaid, do you mind? I know you were talking about, you know, your role within the White House and HHS. Can you talk about that next bridge to get you to the Milken Institute? And then just talk a little bit more about why does this Center for the Future of Aging exist?
Sure. So when I ran the White House Conference on Aging, which was 2014 to 2016, we focused on four issue areas. So that brought me back into retirement security when I hadn't been doing it for quite a while. So we focused on, you know, retirement security, we looked at healthy aging, we looked at long-term care, and also elder justice. So really the issue of, you know, elder abuse in our country and the rights that people have, you know, to sort of really track down people, and not just abuse that's physical, where that certainly is, does happen, unfortunately, but there's a lot of financial abuse, financial scams on older adults, things like that. But when the Milken Institute created the Center for the Future of Aging in 2015, so it was before I got there, I was still at the White House, but the, you know, they had received a grant to look at the best cities for successful aging. So I think there was awareness that people were looking where they should live when they get older, because, you know, things change and what are the best things to do. So we studied really the attributes of what makes a city good for aging. And ARP has now really expanded that. They call it livable communities. And you can put your zip code in and see just the attributes. When I recently moved, I did that. So it looks at things like access to healthcare, to public transportation, how walkable is it, how affordable, you know, do you have access to museums and art, and different things that people like to do as they grow older. So, and I think my White House job really expanded my worldview of much of what we want to do in aging. It touches so many things, because it's not just health, you know, as I said, it's financial security, it's housing, it's transportation. It's, you know, when I was at the White House, we were really involved in almost every single agency, because there's the aspect of it that touches on how to better work for older people. And so at the Milken Institute, you know, I came in as a senior director of our Center for the Future of Aging. I was recently promoted to be the executive director. And we focus on three primary areas. We focus on healthy longevity, which I mentioned before, and that's, you know, prevention. What can you do to stay healthy, such as walking every day, so instead of driving all the time, keep moving. What do we know about mental health well-being of older adults, and what are things that we can do there? We've been focused this year really on looking at tech-enabled health and home care. So how can technology help people stay healthy and out of the hospital, as they get older? And then we also focus on financial security. As I mentioned, we're just launching a new program on the future of retirement, really looking at the 100-year life. You know, children born today are expected to live to at least 100. So thinking about, you know, okay, we have this, you know, bonus 30, 35 years after we're 65, how do we reevaluate how we live our lives and what we do and how we save and how we prepare? We look at long-term care financing, successful housing. And then finally, in July of last year, I launched something called the Alliance to Improve Dementia Care. And this was based on my own experience having care for my dad, who had Alzheimer's disease, and his sister and his two brothers also did as well. So our family was deeply impacted by Alzheimer's disease and working on that. And I came out of that experience really with a passion to sort of change the way that we deliver care to people with Alzheimer's. And, you know, there were many things that happened along my dad's journey, and he was a medical doctor. My sister and I are pretty well versed. You know, we're, you know, white individuals, so we're not discriminated against. And it was an awful experience. It was very fragmented. There was a lot of indignities placed upon him. And, you know, I just came out of that wanting to change it for everyone, realizing, you know, what if I had been Black? What if I didn't speak English? What if, you know, I didn't have an education? Then, you know, we were treated badly despite all these things. And, you know, just imagine how bad it is if we have trouble communicating. So, you know, I've been really working on this effort to change the way we pay for healthcare, to change the way that we do, provide services and care, to make sure that we provide health equity and, you know, are really focused on some of the people who are at greatest risk for Alzheimer's, which, you know, Hispanics have 3 times the risk of white people, Blacks have 2 times the risk of white people, but most of our research and efforts is all focused on, you know, white people of European descent. And so really trying to focus more effort on people who have been left out over the past.
Can you share some more just practical side of the Alliance to Improve Dementia Care? What are some of the other organizations?
Sure, we have
collaborating with, and how's that going?
Nearly 100 organizations now, which is, you know, super exciting, especially since we're just coming up on 2 years. We have AARP, we have Alzheimer's Association, we have many of the pharmaceutical companies that are involved in drug discovery, like Biogen and Eli Lilly, Roche, et cetera. And we also have physician groups, you know, Kaiser Permanente, the health systems such as Providence Health System that are caring for people with dementia. And we have 8, so, you know, we have a circle that shows like all the stakeholders that we work with. So we also have government, we have academics involved, but really importantly to us is we also always make sure that we have people with lived experience and part of all the decisions. We make a bunch of policy recommendations generally, but we make sure in all of those conversations that we have someone who's living with dementia themselves and a caregiver of someone who's living with dementia, just to really get that real experience to make sure the policies that sometimes, you know, people in government or in research institutions think will work on the ground, to like really test them with people who are living through it right now. And like, would this make a difference? Or, you know, and you'll get a lot of good feedback about what's too complicated, what's helpful, what they wish they had known earlier on, those types of things that help drive our work.
By the way, I am on the website right now and I was looking through it. I noticed that one of your partners and sponsors is my alma mater. Although I didn't go to the medical school there, but I did undergrad at Washington University in St. Louis.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We have a great partnership with them. And we have one of our steering committee members is on the, you know, is from WashU. And she's an amazing African-American physician who really cares for people. She sees it firsthand. She'll talk about it. Like, you know, the color of your skin and money that you have in your pocket in our country really determines the type of care that you get. And so she can see sort of the really high-end care. And as you know, having a school there, St. Louis has a large Black population as well. And, you know, seeing the differences in care that are available to poor people versus wealthy people. And, you know, as a result, you see the differences in outcomes, you know, of people that are able to live longer. You know, your health is really tied to how well educated you are, what income you have. Just because, you know, the better educated you are, the more you learn about how to stay healthy, the more financial resources you have, the ability that you have to invest in things like good running shoes or a treadmill or a gym membership or something. And, you know, people that are low income often are worrying about how to pay their rent or how to get food on the table tonight. And so it's not as much of a long-term focus on their health, but then if they become ill, it really impacts their lives, both financially and physically and mentally. So, you know, we're really just trying to build things that they're more equitable.
That's awesome to hear. I wanted to ask you a couple questions on this that relates to just your experience from a broader perspective, working in the nonprofit industry, which is, I'm blown away when I look at your list of partners and supporters, specifically for the Alliance to Improve Dementia Care. One of the challenges that I've seen in the nonprofit industry is how difficult it can be for organizations to partner and collaborate and work together. And there's kind of the good, the bad, you know, of both sides of that. It seems like you all have figured out a model here where you've been able to, you know, truly make 1 + 1 = 3 and bring together collective power. I'm curious if you could just chat about kind of some of the operational things, like, you know, if you were maybe, you know, potentially the Alliance is totally unrelated to healthcare, dementia care, but what are some of the positive outcomes you've seen, like putting together and operating this alliance? What are some of the things that have maybe surprised you and been successful? And then what are some of the things that maybe you guys have changed your strategy just learning over the years?
Absolutely. And my colleague, Diane Tai, and I, who is the director of the alliance, we recently wrote a piece for the Gerontological Society on American
Hello?
Publish it, and when it is, I'll make sure. I think there are a couple things. You know, again, I've worked at small nonprofits, and where you really are living grant to grant to make sure that you're able to pay people's, paychecks and have things there, especially the small area agencies on aging that get government funding, primarily some philanthropic funding. And it's hard for them to have a big picture vision because they're so busy trying to find funds just to keep the lights on. I think that that's a real struggle. And so there is that power of collaboration of where you can join with people and find out what are your strengths. If your strengths are delivering the services, who could you maybe hire to help with the bookkeeping, or who might have the connections to bring you into a broader network and introduce you to other people? So understanding your strengths, but making sure that you're also thinking about those gaps that you have and how can you fill them. So I'd say, when we started off, this is a relatively recent experiment, we had a couple core funders. The Johnny Hartwig Foundation was one. And I was overly ambitious. I was like, oh, we're going to do so much. We're going to do 4 roundtables and we're going to have policy recommendations for everyone, and we're going to publish them. We'll do all this in a year. And that's what I put in the grant. Well, we were exhausted trying to meet all those deliverables. We didn't really figure out how much time it takes to do that, how much, back and forth we'd have with the consensus building process, how then we felt like we couldn't even talk about the recommendations we had because we were, we had to get started on the next one because that was part of the deliverables that we had agreed to. So since then, we really started to be much more thoughtful about what we can accomplish in a calendar year, what kind of staff we need. And I think also the ability to say no. I've been at nonprofits that get really afraid to say no to anything because they don't know where the money's going to come from. But sometimes, in my experience definitely is, a $50,000 grant can take just as much work as a $500,000 grant because you still have to do all the paperwork and reporting and deliverables and stuff. So sometimes you just need to make the assessment, this just isn't worth it because it's going to take so much time and effort away from other projects. We should try to focus on these bigger ones. So I think those are some strategies that we used. I think for all of us that are overachievers, it's hard to say no and think, oh, I can do it all. But I also think, this 24-hour, we can be online all the time. It's just, you can't work 24 hours a day. So, again, I'm a big believer in what I know about healthy longevity. And a lot of that is giving yourself a break, getting a good night's sleep, making sure that you take time for yourself to keep your mental health good, and that helps you to be more productive in the end. But there are those things that we've learned, sort of what is our sweet spot. There are times where, some folks on my team may become creative and they want to go down a path, and it's sometimes you have to realize some of those paths will lead to more enlightenment, but they're not going to lead to actually more funding or more work in that area. But a lot of times I find as a leader, I'll give folks that opportunity to learn that from themselves because they're very excited about it. They want to see something. And I'll say, I don't know if that's really our niche and what we do well, but, if you want to explore it, go ahead. So they'll spend a lot of time doing all that. May ultimately, I'm not always right, so I don't want to say that, but they'll often come back and say, oh my God, this is such a morass. And it's kind of, I know, I thought so, but at least you tried and found out. So, I think some of my lessons are learning how to say no. And that paper that we looked at really the quality of the convenings that you have. So really doing a lot of prep work. You know, I moderate a lot of sessions and a lot of consensus building sessions, and people will see me after. You're so good at that. You're such a natural conversation leader. And the thing they don't know is, like, I prepare for hours in advance. You know, I study who's going to be in the room, what's their background, you know, what connections can I pull upon that can bring them into the conversation? Can, you know, if we have a dead zone, how can I flip to someone to make it more interesting? If somebody's gone off the rail, how do you, you know, get it back on track? So all that has been learned over years, but it also takes a tremendous amount of preparation. So I don't think, you know, I mean, yeah, some people are definitely better at some things than others, but I think that with practice and learning, most people can be good at most things, but, you know, not to recognize that some things really don't, they aren't simple. They take a lot of prep work in the background. So.
Well said. I mean, it's always, I think about it a lot as I was starting and running Charity Charge and, you know, all the challenges we had, you know, just getting off the ground and starting something like this. I always just remembered a quote. It was actually a Tony Robbins one, but he would say, you're rewarded in public for what you practice in private. So
good one. Yeah,
I think about that a lot, and I appreciate you saying that. I want to, with some of the things you touched on there, as we kind of round out this interview, I'd like to touch on, I know you had, well, I want to ask you some questions about leading your team through COVID and now, and also kind of dovetail that with the article that you had written on mental health. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I'm just curious, you know, what's it been like, and what have you been learning the past couple of years? What's it like managing your team? Are you all mostly remote? Just any like kind of fresh perspectives that you've seen as a leader, because there's been a lot of change, right, in the world, and then obviously the nonprofit sector over the past couple of years. So sure. I can be more specific with my questions, or, and I can also give you if you want to start and talk about the article. Yeah.
Feel free to jump in. I would just say, you know, when I first became a manager, one of the books that had a big impression on me was Marshall Goldsmith's What Got You Here Won't Get You There. Mm. And it really helps you think about, you know, and this happens a lot, that people are promoted because they're really strong producers. But mm-hmm. just because you're a strong producer doesn't make you a good manager. And so kind of how you shift what you're focuses on work, the more you go up the ladder and what people need from you. Mm-hmm. So I, as a leader, recognize now that what I say, people take very seriously, and they often, you know, take it very personally. And sometimes I'll just be frustrated myself. I'm having a bad day. You know, yeah. I'm stressed out. And so I'll be short and quick, or like, no, this isn't what I needed. And they're crushed, you know, that Nora doesn't think I'm doing a good job. And then next day it'll be like, no, it's, you know, I was just stressed out because I hadn't had time to prepare. So I think having those conversations, but knowing the expectations that as a leader, your mood really impacts all the people that you're working with, and which can be challenging when you are having your own struggles yourself. I think, you know, we did go remote for about a year and a half. We tried to go back 3 days a week in September, and then Omicron came. So we went back to remote. Now we're trying 2 days in the office. And, you know, people like going back. I think there's pros and cons. So people come back and say, I'm much more productive when I'm home, because when I'm at the office, I get interrupted all the time. If you're like in a, you know, a cubicle, like you don't have much privacy. There's, you know, issues that come up with what you can hear and stuff. You know, I think some of this will even add a little bit once we're used to it. People are just so excited to see human beings again. There's a lot of chit chat, mm-hmm. but then there's also recognizing, you know, that there are things that happen when you run into someone in the ladies' room or getting a cup of coffee that don't happen on Zoom. So, you know, I tend to think a hybrid model works pretty well, but it's also, for a lot of people, it's really challenging to get into an office. So you don't want to lose talent based on that. I think, you know, touching on my article, I've suffered for from depression since I was in my 30s. But, you know, my cycle tended to be, I'd have a major episode where I'd be really depressed and couldn't function, couldn't go to work. And then I'd be fine. And then I'd go back in, you know, guns blazing again. And because of the stigma associated with mental health, I never told people why I was out. I always, you know, said, oh, there's a medical reason. I always felt like I was kind of lying about what was happening, which is hard. And I think even as a leader, you know, there are challenges when you have a mental health condition, reasons that I said, people, you know, I don't want people to think, you know, performance reviews typically happen at the end of the year, for example. I have seasonal affective disorder, so I tend to be in a lower mood at the end of the year. And, you know, so as an employee, they might say, well, I don't want her reviewing me in December because she's depressed, you know, and it's a legitimate point. You're, you know, these mental conditions do impact, you know, your thinking processes. But at the other time, so I was always afraid to disclose. I always had excuses. You know, and then I decided to write the article when, you know, Anthony Bourdain and Kate Spade both died very closely, because I heard a lot of people saying, oh, they're so successful. Why would they ever do this? They're so successful. How could they be depressed? And I thought, you know, that's another thing people don't see. Some of the most successful people publicly are really fighting many demons in their private lives that they don't put out there. And because then sometimes when you become a public figure, there's even more pressure on you to be perfect and happy and engaged all the time, when it's hard to keep that pretense up if you're going through a lot. So I wrote an article just to talk about my experience, but also linking it to public policy. Again, I'm very solutions oriented. So it's like, I don't want to just tell people I had this experience and it's terrible. And one of my big motivators was to try to help other people that may feel alone, that, you know, they're not alone. There are many people who have these struggles, and I think the pandemic has made them worse and exacerbated it for many, many people. But also, just, you know, I feel passionately about suicide prevention, and people just get to their deepest, darkest point in life, and they think that no one, you know, that they don't matter. And it's just so untrue, because when you talk to people, especially people who have lost loved ones to suicide, it's just devastating for the people that love you. And often when you're in your dark place, you don't realize how many people love you and how many people want to support you and how many people really are okay with you not being perfect. So, you know, that was my impetus. And I try to practice what I preach. It's hard to do, but, you know, try to make sure I put time in my day for meditation and for taking a walk, for not working too long, doing all those things, because I've had really hard experience of when I don't put my health first, that it's bad. But it's, you know, I'm a work in progress every single day. And I feel like I learn more about how to manage my mental health condition, and I'm better at it. But I also, you know, a big core message I want to say is, it's not my fault, because I think sometimes we get in a place where, like, if you exercise and if you meditate, if you take your medication, then you're not going to get sick. And if you don't do those things, then you're going to get sick. So it's your fault, you know? And it's like, sometimes you can do everything in the world and you still get depressed. And, you know, so that, I don't like the blaming thing. I think there are things that help us cope, and that we learn together from what, supporting each other, because that's what it's all about. But I also just want to make sure that, you know, people don't take their own lives, because there's so many other alternatives to that. And there's something good to look forward to each and every day.
I appreciate you sharing that so much and just being open about it. It's definitely something that I've struggled with. And I think about starting, well, I think that your message, you know, is really well put for a variety of different people, but I think specific to the Charity Charge and this show, and it's all about how do we share best practices and learnings and kind of support other nonprofit leaders. And as I just continue, you know, to spend my days talking to people running nonprofits, you realize how lonely it can be to be executive director or CEO, you know, et cetera. And again, I mean, I saw that firsthand, because I dealt with so much stress and worries and I mean, months of not sleeping, you know, and all these things that you kind of get to a point where you break, you either, you can break through in different ways. And it's been really interesting battling that, but I hope that this will be a very helpful interview for the organizations that we work with, because it can be very lonely being an executive director of an organization. You've got obviously your staff and employees relying on you, and then you've got, you're balancing out a board. Then you've also got, you know, corporate relationships and other sorts of supporters, and you gotta manage all that. I don't know if there's any closing comments you want to talk about in regards to.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my closing comment is like, be authentic. You know, mm-hmm. you don't have to share everything with everyone, but stay true to your core principles, because I think that can help guide you to get through things. And if something just seems wrong to you, then it's probably wrong. Mm-hmm. And you trust your instincts. So I think that that's been really helpful. And just, you know, knowing how to take care of yourself and knowing that that is still a priority for all the people that rely on you, depend on you. Like, it's, you know, like the cliche, but I'll say it. It's like the airplane where they say, put the mask on yourself before you secure it on someone else. It's really, really important that you take care of yourself so that you can be a good leader to all these people that are depending on you.
Absolutely. So well said. Nora, if people are interested in getting involved, learning more, what's the best way for them to check out your organization, the work you're doing?
Sure. I would just look on our website, the Milken Institute. It's milkeninstitute.org. And then there's the Center for the Future of Aging that's within there. I'm also on LinkedIn. So happy to have anyone connect with me that way. It's just Nora Super on LinkedIn. So
amazing.
That's how we connected, Stephen, right?
That's right. Absolutely. The power of LinkedIn. No, you're totally spot on. I love it. I mean, it's kind of funny if I think about the one tool that has helped me the most at Charity Charge, it's either Salesforce or it's LinkedIn.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just unbelievable. And I think I'd give the nod to LinkedIn because, you know, people and friends are our greatest assets. So it's really cool to be able to just connect with people in a professional way. And it's awesome. So thank you for that. And Nora, thank you for being on this episode of the Charity Charge Show.
All right. Thanks so much, Stephen. It was fun.